It's Wednesday, July 23rd, 2008, and it's 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Hey everyone, welcome to the Daily Audio Stash. Glad to have you here for the middle of the week. Got a lot of good stuff coming up here for you. First, our dose of cannabis science with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Although this time we're going to talk about something a little less scientific. The notion that marijuana helps you with creativity. I know myself as a writer and musician, I've always felt that marijuana helps add a creative spark, but the science isn't exactly in on this subject, so we'll talk to Dr. Mitch and find out what we do know about cannabis and creativity. Also, I've got an essay from Normal's executive director, Alan St. Pierre, where he outlines the top 10 legal issues that we are facing in 2008 as cannabis consumers. It's very informative. You'll want to give it a listen. For our musical break this Hemp Day Hump Day, we've got a little bit of Americana country-type music for you, so you'll get to enjoy that. And don't forget also that we're still running our Pass the Stash contest all the way through the end of July. I'm looking for the stash listener who has been busted with the smallest amount of marijuana. That's right, the story of the person who was busted with the least amount of marijuana will win a copy of the DVD AKA Tommy Chong, the Josh Gilbert documentary detailing another stupid bust, that of Tommy Chong for selling bongs on the internet and him having to do 9 months in prison for it. All right, everybody, let loose and grab yourself a peace pipe, relax, and enjoy your normal daily audio stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Nevada Highway Patrol Sergeant may face grand jury for fatal marijuana DUI charge. From the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Prosecutors claim Sergeant Edward Latin, a 22-year highway patrol veteran who supervised a team that investigates fatal crashes, had enough marijuana in his system to impair his driving during the crash, which happened when he was off duty. They said he smoked at most 4 hours before the crash that occurred on Rainbow Boulevard in the Southwest Valley. Killed in the accident was 49-year-old Ying Warren. Latin was arrested last week on one felony count of driving under the influence, resulting in death. His bail was set at $50,000. Tests showed that 5.6 nanograms per milliliter of tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, were present in the trooper's system before it was metabolized. After it was metabolized, tests showed 26 nanograms per milliliter in his bloodstream. State law allows drivers to have 2 nanograms per milliliter of THC in their system because smoke might have been ingested secondhand. Nevada is one of the states with per se drug driving statutes, which just means you're guilty of being impaired if you have detectable amounts of drugs in your blood, even if you're not actually impaired. It's tragically ironic that a highway patrolman who investigates fatal crashes and was part of the department's advertising campaigns to encourage everyone to drive safe and drug and alcohol free would be the one to allegedly cause a fatal DUI crash. But Sergeant Latin is not the only Nevadan who has faced punishment for causing deaths while driving under the influence. The editorial board of the Las Vegas Review-Journal recalls a very similar case involving a non-police officer. Comparisons to the case of stripper Jessica Williams, who fell asleep at the wheel in March 2000, mowing down and killing six teenagers sentenced for minor infractions to pick up trash in the median of Interstate 15, are unavoidable. Williams, who used ecstasy 10 hours before the crash and smoked marijuana 2 hours before the accident, is serving 18 to 48 years in prison for driving with prohibited substances in her blood, even though her jury determined she was not impaired at the time of the crash. The county authorities who allowed those teens to be placed in jeopardy along that highway faced no punishment whatsoever. Taxpayers covered their liabilities. Will Sergeant Latin now get kid glove treatment compared to what befell Jessica Williams, who was certainly not sent home from the crash site to await developments like Latin was? The sergeant's bail has already been set at a quite manageable $50,000, while Williams was set at $5 million. If the sergeant is indeed found culpable and faces some punishment of less than 18 years in prison, Jessica Williams' punishment should be commuted to match the highway patrolman's. Or do we have different standards of justice in Nevada for cops than we do for strippers? Don't be ridiculous! This is the United States of America, where everyone, from the homeless citizen to the President of the United States, faces the same blind and fair justice system, where no man or institution is above the law, and even the rich and powerful must submit to the same laws as the common folk. Wow, I was able to say all of that with a straight face. New Orleans flooded with felony marijuana cases. From the New Orleans City Business newspaper. Shortly after Kiva Landrum Johnson took over as district attorney, following Eddie Jordan's resignation October 30th, hundreds of new felony cases flooded the public defender's office, overwhelming the 29 defense attorneys. After New Orleans regained its title as the nation's murder capital, the public demanded its city leaders crack down on violent crime. By filing hundreds of new felony cases each month, it appeared as if the new DA heeded their call. Unfortunately, this wasn't the case, said Steve Singer, chief of trials for the Orleans Public Defender's Office. The flood of new felony charges didn't target murderers, rapists, or armed robbers. They targeted small-time marijuana users, sometimes caught with less than a gram of pot, and threatened them with lengthy prison sentences. The resulting impact has clogged the courts with nonviolent petty offenses, drained the resources of the criminal justice system, and damaged low-income African-American communities, Singer said. Landrum Johnson's decision to accept felony charges on people arrested for second and third marijuana possession offenses is a dramatic break from the tactics of former DAs Jordan and Harry Connick. A first-time marijuana possession charge in Louisiana is a misdemeanor punishable by up to 6 months in prison, but typically results in a small fine. A second offense is a felony that can carry up to 5 years in jail, and a third offense up to 20 years. Under Jordan and Connick, however, second and third offenses were routinely reduced to misdemeanors that typically did not require a trial. This freed up public resources to be spent on violent crimes as opposed to minor, victimless offenses, Singer said. Landrum Johnson was unavailable for comment, but her spokesman, Dalton Savoir, said that while he agreed there has been an increase in second and third offense marijuana felony acceptances, the increase is not attributable to a change in policy. Savoir said, quote, "Rather, the increase is a result of the fact that during 2008, it has become easier to obtain certified copies of prior convictions that are required evidence to prosecute second and third offense marijuana cases," end quote. In other words, Savoir said, clerical malfunctions that prevented the DEA from seeking felony prosecutions of marijuana cases in the past have been rectified. none of this would have anything to do with Kiva Landrum Johnson running for a judgeship in Orleans Criminal District Court, would it? Surely this increase in felony prosecution for minor marijuana charges is solely because they fixed a clerical glitch, and not because someone running a political campaign wants to point to her high felony prosecution record and proclaim how tough on crime she is. No, that could not be it. National Institutes on Drug Abuse's latest idea, paying mentally ill substance abusers for clean pee. A new intervention enhances prospects for substance abusers whose mental illness complicates the path to recovery. In a recent clinical trial, a 6-month course of behavioral treatment for substance abuse in severe and persistent mental illness, or BTSAS, reduced drug abuse, boosted treatment session attendance, and improved the quality of life of outpatients with a wide spectrum of mental disorders. Dr. Alan S. Belak and colleagues at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore designed BTSAS to counter the factors that make recovery from addiction especially difficult for people who have co-occurring severe and persistent mental illness. These factors include frequent failure to meet their own and others' expectations, inconsistent motivation, and social and personal pressure to appear normal. Twice-weekly sessions begin with urine tests. Patients who have provided drug-free urine samples are praised by the therapists and group members. They also receive financial incentives that start out at $1.50 for the first drug-free sample and increase in 50-cent increments for every consecutive one thereafter, up to $3.50. The amount is set back to $1.50 after a drug-positive sample or an absence. The researchers reported that the extra costs of running the BTSAS program were modest. For the 6-month trial, monetary rewards averaged roughly $60 per patient. Total per patient cost, including therapist time, was $372.
Let's see. I need to pass a pee test twice a week so I can make $60. Marijuana is relatively expensive, and if I use it, then I could test positive for 2 or 4 weeks. But the crack and the meth, those are real cheap, and if I use some of those after my Thursday test, I'm pretty sure I can clean up in time for my Monday test, since those drugs flush out in just a couple of days. Well, I suppose I could just get drunk as well. That'll clean out pretty quick, and it's legal. I'm completely in favor of more drug rehabilitation and treatment for addiction and for the mentally ill. A drug treatment center saved my dad's life. But any time you bring urine testing into the equation, you create an artificial incentive to stop the safest drug, marijuana, in favor of the harder, less detectable drugs. Also, an addict's recovery needs to be something that is built from within, not incentivized with petty bribery. More Kids Dying, an editorial from the New York Times. Despite a decline in overall drug use, the rate at which young Americans between the ages of 15 and 24 have been dying from drug overdoses has jumped dramatically, more than doubling between 1999 and 2005. In the same period, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, accidental poisoning deaths in this age group, mostly drug overdoses, have jumped from 849 to 2,355. Instead of rushing to save these young people, state governments are actually shortchanging them. Only a tiny fraction of the money that Washington sends to the states under the Substance Abuse and Prevention and Treatment Block Grant Program is aimed at young drug abusers. This cannot go on. Prescription painkillers like oxycodone and Vicodin are the most common drugs involved in fatal overdoses by young people. The problem need not be measured only in fatalities. Other, more familiar kinds of drug abuse have increased as well. The percentage of high school seniors who smoke marijuana on a daily basis tripled from nearly 2% to 6% in the 1990s. The number drifted down to 5.1% last year, but that is still alarmingly high, and marijuana is more potent than ever. The current state funding of drug treatment programs is obviously not enough. If there is any doubt, just take another look at the rising numbers of kids dying from drug overdoses.
And the whole thing has got me wondering, what does the 5% of high school seniors smoking pot have to do with all these overdoses you're worried about? The government has constantly barraged young people with anti-marijuana advertising and stepped up enforcement efforts, arresting more people for pot than ever. Still, one out of 20 high school seniors smoke it, and you've convinced the rest of them that illegal drugs are so bad that they've turned to the legal ones in mom and dad's medicine cabinet. You got less drug use, but ended up with more drug deaths among young people. How is any of this considered a sane drug policy?
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to play Pass the Stash, where you can win cool prizes from Normal.
Hey, Stashers, time for a brand new Pass the Stash contest. This one's going to run all the way through the end of July, so you've got till July 31st to get your entries in to stash@normal.org. Here's the contest, and it's inspired by conversation with a friend of mine, Scott, from Herb Age Designs. Check them out at herbagedesigns.com. And we were talking about what's the smallest amount you've ever heard of anyone being busted for marijuana, the smallest amount in possession. And Scott had quite a surprising answer. I'm not going to give it away yet because I want you guys to enter. So the person who can prove to me that they were busted with the smallest amount of marijuana in grams or less than a gram, just send me an email at stash@normal.org and you could win a copy of the DVD, a.k.a. Tommy Chong, the Josh Gilbert documentary that chronicles Tommy Chong's 9 months in prison that he served for selling bongs on the internet. If yours is the entry with the smallest amount and you can prove it by July 31st, you'll win the DVD. We'll just mail it right out to you. You can remain anonymous and you must be 18 or over to play. And thanks for playing Pass the Stash.
Well, Wednesday has rolled around again, and that means it's time for some more cannabis science with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, who's an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany. And Dr. Earlywine, welcome back to the Audio Stash.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, you know, I know you get a lot of emails, and I do too, from people that are wanting to know about the good features of marijuana. I mean, we see a lot of studies that come out purporting to say all the bad things marijuana will do to you. But in the cannabis community, a lot of us think of marijuana as a enhancement to life. And in particular, a lot of people will say that marijuana enhances the taste of things or the sound of music, or in general, just it enhances creativity. And I was just wondering if there's any sort of scientific backing to that idea that marijuana enhances creativity.
I think we're sort of in a predicament with the creativity literature. It's really hard, as you can imagine, to measure creativity in the lab. And when we do try to do that and get people high and have them do these creativity tasks, we don't see a lot of improvement. There was one study in the early 90s that showed some modest improvements, and then one more recent that didn't. I think part of it is that creativity has to be broken down into different little steps. You sort of need a period when you're generating ideas, as crazy as they may be. Cannabis may have some big pluses for that sort of side. And then another side where you just sort of let a creative idea incubate for a little while, and whether cannabis has an impact on that or not, we just don't know. And then this notion of sorting through the ideas and picking the one that's more practical or creative or things along those lines. And it looks like cannabis doesn't seem to be a ton of help with that. Part of how this whole idea developed, though, is going back to some rather famous folks who happen to be creative and also use marijuana. But again, as we've talked about when we look at other literatures, it's just a correlation. It may not be causal. But still, they're an interesting group, and an interesting story about this. Probably the one I hear about the most is the Hashish Club.
Yeah.
In the 1840s, there's a really pretty famous physician back then, Jean-Jacques Moreau, and I apologize, my French is not good if I'm mispronouncing it. And he was actually trying to study hashish's impact on thought and emotion and things like that, and was thinking maybe it would be an interesting model to help people understand, you know, deviations in thought and even mental illness. And he basically dished out hash in this form of this little confection. This was a sugar and spice and hash treat, if you will. People all ate it. And a number of the famous French artists and writers of that era seemed to show up. And a bunch of them claimed they only showed up to observe, which I think we know what to make of that. But Alexandre Dumas of Three Musketeers fame, Baudelaire, Gautier, a number of famous French poets and artists, and it's intriguing to note that, you know, people who are willing to commit their lives to a creative lifestyle are also willing to be more adventurous in other domains, and I think that that may account for some of this relation between creativity and cannabis use.
Once again, we're back to that correlation versus causation. Is it the fact that cannabis makes you more creative, or do more creative people just tend to get involved with cannabis?
It's funny, too, because I invariably meet folks who tell me about their cannabis-induced insight and the one that seemed to be the great idea for them. And in truth, even for my dissertation back in 1990, I got a really neat idea when I happened to be high that was really instrumental for that project. But I have no idea whether I would have gotten that idea anyway or if it would have you know, come up in another context. So there's really no way to know that. And even this randomly assigning folks to use cannabis or not isn't really showing up as a be-all and end-all, but I think in part there's a creative lifestyle, if you will. If you're willing to be flexible with your thoughts, relax, don't pressure yourself, give yourself time to let good ideas incubate, and then, you know, throw out crazy ideas and just go wild and really give yourself a chance to pursue them, what a wonderful thing. Whether you're using cannabis or not, I think you're going to come up with neater, more creative outcomes in the long run.
Yeah, and this is something that's been observed, you know, not, like you said, going all the way back to the mid-1800s. My frame of reference on this would be the comedian Bill Hicks from the 90s, who once had the observation that if you wanted to trade record collections, he'd take all the records that were composed by people that were on drugs, and you could have the ones by the people who weren't on drugs and see who ended up with the better record collection, you know, mentioning the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix and so on. So, you know, I just tend to think that, and this is, you know, just my personal opinion, is that the people that are creative types and, like you say, have the open mind and are willing to think out of the box are the same kind of people that are the kind of people who question authority and are not likely to take the reefer madness lies at face value. They're more likely to want to experiment and try that on their own. Do you see anything like that in the numbers or the studies of people that try these things?
Well, the studies, again, that was done in the early 90s, it's this cognitive flexibility aspect. And so what often happens is if people are willing to entertain something that sounds completely insane, that's how they come up with novel solutions to problems. Mm. So if instead of saying, oh, my God, I've got to fix this, how am I going to do it, you say, gee, what would be the stupidest way to solve this problem, and come up with completely insane things, and then sure enough, sometimes that's the thing that works. So a relatively famous case study in creativity, they said, okay, you guys, you've got these two heavy metal bars. How are you going to stick them together so they fit? And somebody was joking around and said, let's stick gum in there. And then it turned out they had basically developed a glue that was based on a gum base. So it was kind of curious how these crazy ideas that seem, you know, flip or insane at the time end up being a neat foundation for novel solutions to interesting problems.
You know, we see a lot of the substance using community, and not just cannabis, but we see a lot of this of other substances in the artistic professions, between musicians and artists and actors and so on. We get references back to, you know, Edgar Allan Poe and drinking, Hemingway and his drinking, the use of absinthe and so on. do you see this as being part of that that tortured soul idea? These tortured souls that have to medicate themselves. Could that be part of what's happening here?
Don Goodwin had a wonderful book on this and said the highest risk group for alcoholism is American winners of the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yeah.
And in fact, you start walking through them all, and sure enough, all but one of them is a pretty serious alcoholic. I think some of that is the stressors of trying to have a life that depends upon that kind of output. So once you make this commitment to the arts or writing or things like that, or even, you know, trying to be creative in the sciences, you end up putting a certain amount of pressure on yourself. If you don't have good training in alternative ways to reduce stress, you can see how people do that. The other thing with alcohol in particular is there does seem to be some attentional focus attributed to moderate levels of intoxication, so it's easier to tune out from distractions with that. But obviously this is not the way to have a long career in the creative arts, and you see this time and again, Hemingway late in his life, or other writers who never really got quite so famous. Dashiell Hammett seemed to have run into some problems, John M. Cain, you know, under other folks who were really great at one time, but eventually, you know, trying to let, as Hemingway would say, let the corn whiskey do it, and that just doesn't seem to pan out.
Yeah. Now, you know, creativity exhibits itself in places other than just the creative arts. We could look to the world of science, and you know, two names come to mind in my reference here would be Carl Sagan, the famous physicist and astrophysicist, and Francis Crick, who helped to discover the double helix structure of DNA. And both of them relate having certain insights. You know, Carl Sagan mentions being the insight under cannabis, and Dr. Crick mentioned his insights coming from LSD trips on occasion. Do you see a lot of that in the scientific community?
Well, and in fact, it's interesting because I always thought, oh, these are apocryphal, these are silly. Lester Grinspoon had a talk with Carl Sagan one-on-one and has no reason to, you know, lie about this, and he really did have those insights. And the Watson and Crick thing is also neat, that basically the formulation of that double helix came during a hallucinatory experience. But even if you look back in ancient times, people don't know the name Kekule, but he's actually the guy who figured out that carbon forms a ring, and he was just kind of dozing off by the fire and may have had a drink or two, but basically had a little dream about a snake, and then the snake bit its own tail and formed this little circle. And then suddenly it like dawned on him, holy cow, the carbon is making this ring. I need to go have this. And, you know, what a surprise. I think really any way that you can sort of get out of your regular fixed thinking patterns and go about creative tasks, you're often delighted. And I do want to emphasize that you don't have to be a writer or an artist or painter along those lines. We all have creative things going on in our lives. You get interesting insights about things about your cooking or just how you want to interact with your kids or things like that. By all means, let those run and really have a good time with them.
Yeah, Dr. Lewin, I think this is a great subject, this idea of creativity and opening up the mind. It's something I wish that we could had a better way of studying. And is there any plans on or anybody that's looking into this field of research?
My colleague James Kaufman, who's out in San Bernardino, who was actually an undergrad at USC when I still taught there, is doing some neat work on it. And I'm actually trying to get a questionnaire approved by my ethics board to just have people basically do a thing sort of like those New Yorker cartoons where they just write little captions to these pictures and then those get rated for creativity. And once I have that approved, I'll ask everybody on the stash to click on a link and jump right in on that. I think we'd get a real kick out of those data.
Yeah, that would be like a lot of fun to see. We'll be glad to participate in that. Dr. Lewin, thanks for joining us again here on the stash with more cannabis science.
Oh, thanks so much.
It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our daily audio stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. All right, time for our Hemp Day Hump Day break, Stashers. I hope you get to go to a festival or two this summer. Today's musical break comes from an artist who knows a thing or two about festivals. Michael Gaither brings us his take on the festival experience with his song, High and Lonesome. A bit of bluegrass, some Americana, and a good dose of comedy put this track as a must-add on your road trip CD. Folk music is perfected in the storytelling, and Michael Gaither spins his tale with heart and soul, a guitar and a mic. Visit his website for more great American music. Find him at michaelgaither.com, or even better, if you're in Watsonville, California, you can stop at the Wooden Nickel Bar and Grill, where Michael encourages other songwriters to try their hand at the mic. May you have fun and be safe. Be high and be loved at any festivals that you visit this summer. And again, for more information on Michael Gaither and his albums and music, check out our links at our blog, stash.normal.org, where you can also get an MP3 download of this song. It's Michael Gaither with High and Lonesome.
I met her at a festival on one hot summer day, dancing in the meadow to a bluegrass band on stage. Standing in the beer line, saw her and I knew the body of an angel, a face like Amy Lou. Waded through the tie-dye and low-back concert chairs, true love within my reach as I saw her standing there. Moving past the t-shirt stand, finally made my way. I walked up beside her and found the nerve to say I was high,
high
and lonesome,
lonesome,
sad and blue.
Ooh.
So high,
high
and lonesome,
lonesome,
until I found you. Talked about the music, and it was clear to me, from Bill Monroe to Newgrass, she knew her history. I was singing sad old songs till I found this girl, a happy man again, sitting on top of the world, 'cause I was high,
high.
Sad and blue, so high,
high
and lonesome,
lonesome,
until I found you. I heard opposites attract, I think the opposite is true. I told her how I felt it, and I knew, too shy to tell me, she took me by the hand and pointed out her boyfriend playing banjo in the band. Thank you. in the grass again. Happens every year. Thinking how I saw her standing over here. The music ain't the same no more. It's very sad but true. And every time I hear a banjo, it just gives me the blues. Now I'm high,
high
and lonesome,
lonesome,
sad and blue. So high,
high
and lonesome,
lonesome,
darling, without you.
Hi, I'm Keith Straub, the founder of Normal. In all the years since 1970 that I've been fighting marijuana prohibition, I've learned that drug warriors love to confuse the public with statistics. Lately, they've claimed that there are more teens enrolled in drug treatment for marijuana than ever before. It's a statement that, while true, is intentionally misleading. What they don't tell you is that marijuana arrests have skyrocketed to over 800,000 arrests per year. They also don't tell you that we've gone from a few dozen drug courts in the 1990s to over 2,500 drug courts today. The kicker is that those drug courts sentence teens routinely to drug treatment for marijuana whether they need drug treatment or not. So they arrest more people for pot, require them to enter drug treatment, then claim the higher treatment numbers justify more pot arrests. It's an absurd proposition, but no more absurd than banning a plant. Learn the facts about pot. Visit norml.org today.
The top 10 legal conundrums facing the cannabis community for 2008. An essay by Normal Executive Director Alan St. Pierre.
Every 38 seconds in the United States, a person is arrested on cannabis charges. 830,000 in 2006, nearly 90% for the offense of possession only. The vast majority of citizens arrested on cannabis-related charges fall into the predictable categories of possession, cultivation, sales, transportation, conspiracy, driving under the influence of drugs, and paraphernalia, where applicable. For most of these offenses, there is long-established case law and defenses for citizens charged. However, there are a growing number of instances where citizens and governmental institutions clash in courts, hospitals, national borders, universities, roadsides, and science labs over a series of unique and likely unintended policy outcomes and consequences of the now eight-decade-old prohibition of cannabis. Here are the top 10 legal conundrums that Normal is currently tracking that go beyond the average pot bust. Number 1. Medical patients, notably state-sanctioned medical marijuana patients who have a physician's recommendation to use cannabis, being denied access to organ transplants because they tested positive for cannabis. Well, these individuals often suffer needlessly and/or have a premature death. Number 2. Medical patients, notably state-sanctioned medical marijuana patients who have a physician's recommendation to use cannabis, being denied access to pain clinics, Veterans Administration hospitals, and their attendant medications, like opiate-based drugs such as OxyContin, Vicodin, and Percocet, because, you guessed it, they tested positive for cannabis. Number 3. Parents who use cannabis having their custodial rights challenged, the children taken away, and moved to foster care. Again, This is even occurring to parents who are state-sanctioned medical marijuana patients and who have a physician's recommendation to use cannabis. Number four, increasingly, and highly disrupted ability to cross the international borders with Canada, Mexico, and Caribbean countries. Americans, as well as Canadians trying to enter the U.S., are often turned away at the border because of a past arrest for cannabis or any drug-related offense, including DUI. Even more disturbing, citizens from both countries can be denied entry absent any criminal record at all, and for no reason more simply than the citizen's name was Googled, and if any entries are found that might lead the border agent to believe that the citizen is sympathetic to cannabis. Oh, for example, a couple years ago, normal interns denied entry into Canada at Blaine, Washington for having nothing more than swag from the Seattle Hemp Fest. Or cannabis law reform activists being denied entry into Canada because an internet search turned up articles, letters to the editor, or blog posts indicating the author's fondness or whatnot for cannabis. Number five, Department of Homeland Security, notably its Customs and Immigration Services. Highway roadblocks occurring far distances from international borders. In states such as Arizona, U.S. Customs and Immigration are setting up roadblocks hundreds of miles from the border under the guise of trying to catch undocumented workers, but are often doing little more than busting cannabis consumers and smugglers. These federal law enforcement roadblocks appear to be an attempt to get around a 2000 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Indianapolis versus Edmund, that largely prohibits these kind of nilly-willy roadblocks on our nation's highways. Number six, non-citizens arrested on cannabis and drug-related charges and judges not allowing them to assert individual rights, constitutional protections, and legal defenses therein because of their immigration status. Number seven, a continuing wave of cannabis consumers arrested on cannabis-related charges, usually cultivation, and increasingly DUID, who claim a religious exemption to the Controlled Substances Act. Many of these cannabis consumers have purchased a, quote, religious defense kit, unquote, from an internet site based in Hawaii, a self-proclaimed THC ministry. And they have unsuccessfully asserted a legal exemption from current state and federal prohibition laws. Number eight. A number of students and faculty at state universities and colleges who are state-sanctioned medical marijuana patients who have a physician's recommendation to use cannabis have been denied an exemption from cannabis prohibition laws to possess cannabis on school property, while at the same time being allowed to possess drugs far more dangerous than cannabis, like Valium, Vicodin, Percocet, and of course, alcohol and tobacco products. Number nine. An ever-increasing law enforcement reliance on high-tech interdiction devices and body scanning are creating both numerous legal challenges in the courts and in scientific labs. These days, citizens traveling via car, train, or air can be exposed to numerous high-tech and invasive technologies calibrated to detect the pot in your pocket or handbag. Devices such as ion scanners, full-body scans, gamma-ray devices, computer-operated sniffing devices, and the use of DNA to track cannabis from the grower to the end consumer. Number 10. There is an immense need today for reciprocity laws to be enacted in as many states as possible, most certainly in every state that allows patients to consume cannabis, to stop the non-commonsensible practice of sanctioned medical cannabis patients being treated like violent criminals simply because they crossed state lines. Most especially in states where medical cannabis is legal. An example, California medical marijuana patients who travel to Oregon, Washington, Nevada, and Colorado, for example, are arrested for possessing their own medicine.
There is a peaceful solution called a peace revolution. Now let's take back America.
Since 1970, Normal and its National Legal Committee, comprised of over 500 criminal defense lawyers nationwide, constantly litigate and defend the rights of cannabis consumers in both run-of-the-mill and highly unique cannabis-related cases. We do so to be treated by the government with the same respect social norms and tax and control policies as alcohol, tobacco, and pharmaceutical consumers. This is Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C.
Thank you for downloading the NORML Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.norml.org. For everyone here at NORML, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another cannabis quote, this one from former Marine and current talk show host, Montel Williams, who said, quote, "Oxycontin and Vicodin are extremely addictive. Percocet didn't work. Marijuana is the best tool for me," end quote. And Montel Williams has been a crusader for the rights of patients to use marijuana medically with a doctor's supervision in his states of New York and Connecticut, and he's been testifying all over the East Coast, and good on him. Thanks for helping us out on this one. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us here for the podcast, and we'll be back tomorrow, Thursday, with some 420 comedy featuring Terry Joyce and special guest, and more news and interviews you can use for the cannabis community. And until that time, take care of each other, tokers.